they encircle me. And they're helping me get out of my parachute harness, my helmet. They help me out of my flight suit. They take my boots. They take my socks. They take my Sammy Seiko watch. And I'm left there in my shorts. And this is the first time I was aware of the fact that it's cold in North Vietnam in late December. And so for the first time, with all the adrenaline pumping, that I feel cold. And I notice that both of the shins are bleeding. And I figure, well, okay, this is it. This is where it ends. And then I happen to notice, what I am expecting to see in their eyes is hatred. What I am seeing, though, is curiosity. They're looking at me like, whoa, what is this thing? And I don't know. I might have been the first Caucasian that these people had ever seen. But that's what I saw, was curiosity more than hatred, which was a bit relieving. And then they kind of dabbed at the blood on my shins, and I thought, well, that's not something they'd probably be doing if they were going to shoot me here in the next minute or two.
Were these all men?
Yes, they were.
How many, about?
About a dozen.
And dressed, do you remember?
I don't remember. I know none were in uniform.
Okay,
they were all
in
civilian clothing.
Uh-huh.
And they're talking a mile a minute. They're really pumped. They're excited. And they walked me down to this path in front of the farm, and we're walking down this road. And every once in a while, they'll stop, and there'll be an argument. And, of course, I'm thinking the argument is, half of them are saying, let's take him to the hamlet and turn him in and get all those goodies that the government's promised us. And the other half saying, the hell with that, let's take him out over here to the side of the road and just shoot him. Mm-hmm. And my frustration is, I don't know which side to be cheering for, because I don't understand any Vietnamese. Probably more likely, Laura, it was probably half of them were from Hamlet A, and the other half were from Hamlet B. And they were arguing about which hamlet they were going to turn me into. But what they did do was took me to another farm, took me in the house, and obviously the residents of this farm, now they were really kind. They gave me some hot tea, and they were, I would say, friendly. And I was there with them and the dozen that had captured me when a couple of guys come in uniform, and they're young. They look about the age of my two boys, and that they were at that time. And now I'm seeing what I had anticipated in the first place. This is hatred. I mean, the hate in their eyes is unmistakable. So I'm thinking, what I am reading in this guy, one guy's eyes, is if I can get you away from these people, you're dead. And so my mission in life at that time was to make sure they didn't separate me from the people that lived there in that farm. And within minutes, there's about six or seven other military that show up.
Mm-hmm.
They take me out of the farmhouse, put me on top of this, I don't know what they had on this truck. They had something on the truck, bed, with a tarp over it, and they put me up on top of the load and the tarp, and then off we went to the hamlet. And they put me in this little room in the hamlet where I was. This is the middle of the night. We got shot down about 2 o'clock in the morning, so it's probably, what, 3 in the morning?
Mm-hmm.
And they put me in this little room and tie me up, and that's where they leave me. And then during the day, they had a guard on the door of the room. And about every minute or two, well, not every minute or two, but every once in a while, he would open the door, and there'd be a group of four or five people, and he'd let them look at me for 30 seconds to a minute, and then he'd close the door again.
Now, did you look back up at them, or were you keeping...
Oh, yeah, and they weren't very friendly. These weren't very friendly people. And then some of them, the younger boys, would come around and pound on. There was one window, there was no glass there, just bars. but they'd pound on that, and they were yelling. And this went on until about mid-afternoon. And then about mid-afternoon, I could tell that there was a crowd of people gathering out there. And then a guy with a bullhorn starts talking to them. And this guy was good. Boy, you could just hear that crowd. He was working them up big time. And I, within minutes, when the door opened, I just knew, and I wasn't looking forward to this.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy comes and drags me out. And this guy with the bullhorn, he's talking and pointing to me, and the crowd's going crazy. But they formed a line, and it's kind of a tunnel that that obviously I'm going to have to go down.
Mm.
And at the end of it is this truck. And I noticed that there's another line of people 90 degrees to the line that I'm looking at. So we start down the gauntlet, and there's myself. They're pushing me down to go down this path,
right.
And then two guards behind me. And this is the one time where I was getting hit with sticks and, you know, a few rocks and things like that. The people were upset. And when I got to where there was a line of people 90 degrees, there was Lou Bernasconi, my radar.
No kidding.
Yeah, they're running him down that gauntlet. And then they ran us together to the truck. So they're putting us in the truck, and then they blindfold us. And just before they put the blindfold on, I could see that my gunner, my co-pilot, and my navigator were already on the truck. So the first time in about 2 hours, I have something to be happy about. I'm realizing that five of the six of us are alive. I have not seen the EW.
John, what was it like when you first saw Lou when your eyes met? Do you remember?
Well, no, I don't. But I would imagine it was probably, we were probably really scared about what comes next. But in a way, relieved to see that each other was alive.
I'm sure you must have.
Yeah, I think it was kind of mixed emotions.
John, had you assessed in the time that you were sitting and all the crowd was gathering, had you assessed how well you were, whether things were broken or what?
Yeah. Yeah, I knew I wasn't seriously injured.
Okay. What were your injuries, can you say?
Yeah, I had shrapnel injuries on both shins. And surprisingly, I had a bad bruise right on the middle of my chest. Yeah, and I'm sure it was from the opening shock of the chute with that metal belt on the parachute harness.
Mm-hmm.
And but that was really the extent of my injury.
So you didn't think anything was broken?
No.
That's astounding.
And as it turned out, it wasn't, because so many guys had seriously broken arms, dislocated shoulders from the ejection. In fact, the majority of the guys there had
shoulders broken, pelvises broken.
Yeah,
just
right.
From really horrendous.
Yeah, I was. Well, you know, and Laura, that's my closing, not my closing, but another mandatory comment that I make in all speaking engagements is, if you have to be a POW, and God forbid that you would, but if you find yourself as a POW, I pray that you are as fortunate as I was. I mean, think about it. Those guys were up there seven and a half years. I was there a little over 3 months. We lost 10 B-52s in the Hanoi area. We had about a 50% loss rate. About half the crew members survived. One crew, the entire crew, survived and came home. And, I mean, if you have to be, and I had no serious injuries. I mean, if you have to be a POW, you couldn't ask for better luck than I had. I didn't, and another thing that bothered me, in the last couple of weeks we were up there talking to some of the other aircraft commanders,
mm-hmm.
and one of the things they were concerned, when it looked like we might get a go home, and one of the biggest concerns they had was the visit they were going to have to make to the wife or the parents of some of their crew members that weren't around, that didn't make it. And I was spared that. I didn't have to do that since my entire crew survived.
And just to clarify, this was the only crew
right
throughout the B-52
that
runs.
Was shot down and went down in the Hanoi area. Now, there was a B-52 crew that made it back to Utapau. They crash-landed, but some of them were killed in the crash landing.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there were only two survivors. The co-pilot and the gunner were the two survivors on that airplane. But John Mize, he got his airplane back into northern Thailand and bailed out, and they all bailed out
mm-hmm.
successfully. Mm-hmm. But they were not POWs. They weren't captured. They were back in Thailand.
But of the B-52?
Of the B-52s that were shot down in the Hanoi area, and subsequently their crew became POWs. Mine was the only crew where the entire crew survived and came home.
I mean, that's just amazing.
Oh, it is. I mean, I was just so fortunate.
Well, and the fact that you were able to account for all but one within the first day, you knew that they were alive.
Yeah, that night. I mean, that was as they're
can't
taking
even believe
us,
it.
They're taking us to Hanoi, and I know that five or six of us are alive.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why I say for the first time in about 3 hours, I had something good that I felt good about something. And the ride, I'll tell you, the ride to Hanoi was really, that was exciting. They had the driver, one guy riding shotgun up front, and that was it. They got the two guys up front, and they got the five of us in the back. Of course, we're tied up we're tied up and blindfolded.
Right.
Back, and we're in the back of that truck.
Are you talking to each other?
No. What was that? Maybe that there might have been, I think there might have been one other guy in the back with us, because I'd said something once and I got hit
uh-huh.
with a gun, you know, with a gun butt.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, I guess that means we're not supposed to talk. And I couldn't see him. So I don't think we did talk
mm-hmm.
on the way in.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that the road that we went in on must have been bombed a lot, because you could feel we were having to go out in the boonies to get around, I assume, bomb craters or something on the road. We did a lot of that. And every hamlet we'd come into, you could hear the people as we'd come into the hamlet. So they must have alerted them
mm-hmm.
that, hey,
mm-hmm.
there's a truck coming in with some American POWs. And then these kids, they jump on the truck, and they were rocking it back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, this truck's we're never going to make it to Hanoi. They're going to turn this thing over, and that's going to be it.
I mean, that must have been horrendously frightening.
Oh,
never,
it was. It was.
I mean, just on tenterhooks, not
yeah,
knowing what.
Yeah, and this is, you know, this goes on. This is probably a two-hour ride because of the roads and everything else, and I don't think they ever got over 5 miles an hour. So we're... So anyway, we finally make it to the Hilton, and still blindfolded when they take us off when they take me off the truck. And I remember that when they took me to my cell, there were about three steps going up to the cell they put me in. Guy walked me right into these steps, you know, and so I fall down when I hit the steps. And then they take me in the room, put me on a stool, and this guy would hit me with an open hand across the side of the face. And as long as I was tensed up, he didn't hit me. But as soon as I started relaxing, then I'd get hit again. And this went on for a few minutes. I had to take a drink, Laura, here.
Sure, John.
Anyway, that went on for a few minutes. And then he left, and I was in this cell, and I was in solitary confinement for a week before they moved me in with some other guys. So this is the morning of the 22nd of December, and December the 25th, Christmas, there's no bombing. Well, that's the other thing. Every night, of course, when the bus come, you can hear the bombs going off, being dropped.
Oh, yeah.
You hear the air raid sirens. And they had some woman that I think they were driving around in a truck around the Hilton there with a loudspeaker system on the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously she was telling the people, you better get in your shelters because they're coming. And I would imagine they could give them plus or minus 5 minutes when the bombs were going to be falling. But interesting to hear these bombs going off every night when you're in the cell.
Were you restrained in the cell?
No. No.
What did you do when you heard her going around and you figured out that meant the bombs were about to fall? Did you just get on the dirt? Or?
No, I didn't. Not until the 26th.
Okay.
And then I sure as hell did, because everything was pretty far away from the Hilton. There weren't any bombs dropping close to the Hilton until the 26th of December. Mm-hmm. Of course, 25th, that's a big stand-down day. I mean, would SAC ever bomb anybody on Christmas Day? Heavens no. But there was a bigger reason. The buffs were getting tired. The airplanes were in bad need of some serious maintenance. So they wanted the day to stand down and get the airplanes fixed. But it also helped the North Vietnamese because they were running short of SAMs. So they were able to truck in some more SAMs. And the big show was the 26th, the day after Christmas.
Right.
That was the big show. And that night, some B-52 put a string of bombs in about two blocks from the Hanoi Hilton. And I am sure that it was not by design. I'm sure there wasn't any target there. It was just that the guy probably had a similar situation to what we had. And probably the airplane was either out of control or he was doing something. And about that time, the radar was dropping the bombs. But that was really frightening. I mean, you've heard the stories about people that have lived through arc light strikes in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam.
Sure.
And how they describe it, it's all true. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. The plaster was falling out of the ceiling. I was, and your comment about what did you do, now I'm back in the corner of this cell, huddled in the corner with my fingers and my ears just as deep as I can get them because it just felt like my eardrums were going to rupture. From the noise, but the concussion was what really got me. Over the bars in the window were wooden shutters.
Mm-hmm.
Those things were banging back and forth like they were made out of cardboard. And I can remember vividly thinking, how ironic is this? I get hit. I bail out. I survive the bailout. I'm captured. I become a POW. And this is the way I'm going to check out.
I'm going to be killed in a B-52
I'm going to be killed in a B-52 strike. Dropped by buddies of mine who I was up there flying with three nights ago. And I thought, this is the irony of ironies. And I just really did think this is it. And I thought, well, I guess God has a sense of humor. Saying, right? I could just imagine God saying, so John, tell me, would you rather be the bomber or the bombee?
John, let me ask you, we've got a few minutes left today, but let me ask you about, if you don't mind and if you feel able to say anything about this, about that first week of being by yourself,
mm-hmm.
And presumably, you were by yourself with God, I would think.
Yep.
Can you talk about anything that you could provide, I think, will be interesting about your spiritual feelings
yep.
during that time?
I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I, and this is in reflection, looking back,
mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that one thing that made it, let me make a statement before.
Sure. Okay.
And that is, and this is another thing I always say at speaking engagements,
mm-hmm.
my experience as a POW, it's a compared to experience. Compared to the real POWs, the seven-year guys, my POW experience was like a stroll in the park on a Sunday afternoon. Compared to anything else that I've experienced in my life, it was the most trying thing I've ever been exposed to. So I like to put it in that context.
Mm-hmm.
It was nothing compared to what those guys went through. But when I compare it to anything else in my life experience, it was the most stressful and demanding thing I think ever. Now, having said that, and back to your question, I really do truly believe, Laura, that I am a pretty religious guy, and I have a very strong faith and belief in God. And I think it really, really helped me in that situation. One of the things that I remember specifically was looking at Dave Drummond and Gary Morgan and Bill Mayall, the three kids on our crew.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, this is terrible for these guys. At least, you know, we had our seven kids, and we had had a good life. I said, I've had a good life. I've had seven kids. I mean, I've had a great life. But look at these guys. They're just starting their lives. And how terrible for them if this is it, if this is the end. How terrible for them. So that kind of made it easier for me when I looked at it from that perspective. But just, and, oh, Laura, I mean, you wouldn't believe the praying I did in that week in solitary. And, I mean, this was what I call real praying, not, you know, not reciting the Our Father or the Hail Mary. But this is, I can remember saying, God, you know, I'm not going to be formal with this. This is, I'm in deep trouble here, and I need some help. And I also believe that I have a very, very strong family network.
Yes.
And I know there was a lot of praying going on for me. I've got to tell you, along this line of faith in God and belief, there's a guy named Dan Gansky. He was a Braniff pilot. He was a Southwest pilot. He and I flew B-52s. We went to B-52s at the same time. We both flew F-86s before B-52s. This guy's from Schulenburg, Texas, an A&M graduate. I mean, is this the typical Air Force pilot type?
Oh, yeah.
A&M, good old boy. And he is the typical A&M guy, just a wonderful human being. But Dan, at the time I got shot down, was flying for Braniff, and he was flying out of DFW.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess DFW wasn't even here yet.
Love.
Out of Love, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was stationed here, living in one of the suburbs between here and Dallas. But, of course, he and his wife came over here immediately when they got word that I had been shot down. And later, when I got home, and Dan had a big party for me at his house, and he said, John, he said, when you got shot down, the first thing I did was call Jesse. And I said, who in the hell is Jesse? And he said, well, Jesse, Kelly, I can't even talk about
these. That's okay. You can take a breath, John. It's fine. Do you want me to stop for a minute?
No. Let me just compose myself here if
That's
I can.
That's fine. Of course. Take your time, John.
This guy, Jesse, was a friend of Dan's from Schulenburg, Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, anytime anybody has a serious, serious situation, Jesse is kind of the designated prayer at this little community. And when people are in big trouble, they go to Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
I called Jesse, told him to pray for me. I think that's Jesse and many others is what brought me back.
John, let's take a break there. Here you go. Go ahead.
Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the way Rose found out is the way most spouses find out, when the blue car pulls up in the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, she was hearing the news, too. In fact, let me put this on speaker, Laura,
sure.
And then Rose can chime in, because sometimes I get the facts wrong.
Okay.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi, Rose.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very good. How are you?
I'm fine.
Any help you can give us here would be great.
I think the way it played out, Rose, was that on a Sunday, you had taken the kids?
We had gone out shopping. It was before Christmas.
But it was one of whatever kids' turn it was to go shopping. But anyway, while you were shopping, you heard on the news that another B-52
had gone down.
Two more?
Yeah, she had heard on the news that two more B-52s had gone down, but I think that was all the information they had.
Yeah.
And I guess it was that night then, wasn't it, when the blue car came?
Yes, 1 o'clock.
And, yeah, it was 1 o'clock in the morning, and all the kids were home except for Susie. Our oldest was at somebody else's house.
Mm-hmm.
And, well,
holds up?
Well, they sent the buddy that of Jack's, supposedly, and a psychiatrist and a priest, I think, because they knew we had a bunch of kids.
Yes.
They came in, and all I asked them is he was alive, and they wouldn't answer me. They said they had to read that stupid letter.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did, and they asked me if there was anything they could do, and I said, yes, leave.
You said, yes, leave?
So I just wandered around the rest of the night because one of my kids was sick. And the next morning I got up and went to Mass. And when I came home, the whole world was in my yard. All the commanders from the base and people I never heard of.
Were Dan and Jeannie there then?
No, they were gone somewhere. They didn't get there till that afternoon.
Oh, they didn't?
They were here when we got the call that you were alive.
Oh, okay.
And how long did that call take to arrive, Rose?
It wasn't bad. It was about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and I had learned about it at 1 o'clock that morning. So it was just about 12, 13 hours.
That was a pretty long 13 hours.
Oh, yeah, but not compared to years.
No, I know. I know. I recognize what you're saying and the honor that you're paying to the other families and POWs, and I certainly respect that.
Now, Laura, let me interject another war story here.
Okay.
There was a Fort Worth Star-Telegram reporter by the name of Martha Hand. And Martha Hand was assigned this story.
Yeah.
So she calls Rose. And in the course of the interview, she asks Rose, well, Rose, what are you going to do about Christmas? You know, this is the, what was this?
23rd
or 24th of December. And Rose said, well, we're going to have Christmas. You know, 7 kids, and the article that came out in the paper evidently said was along the line of, well, the wife doesn't seem too concerned about the fact that her husband's shot down. And, you know, maybe dead. She said, we're just going to go on business as usual. Martha never got to talk to Rose again after that.
I'll bet she didn't.
Neither did anybody else.
All you have to do is mention Martha Hand, and Rose comes up free.
Good for you, Rose. I think that was an appropriate response to that.
So, but I'll tell you, Laura, Rose was, we were so fortunate, just like I told you about me, if you have to be a POW.
Yes, yes.
Same with Rose. Like she said, 1 o'clock in the morning, she gets the word, and, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, she gets a call from Randolph. And the way they were able to determine that I had been captured was that some of our people in Havana, Cuba, saw a television broadcast, and it showed pictures of the latest B-52 crew shot down,
mm-hmm.
and they sent copies of that back to the Air Force here. I don't know if they went through the OSI or who it was, but anyway, they got the word back to the Air Force that they had positive proof that we had been that we had survived and that we were prisoners of war,
and that they had done some clearly someone had done some recognition as to who it was that had been identified in the group photographs.
Well, these were individual shots.
Oh, okay. Do you remember being photographed, John?
I don't remember that picture that I saw. Now
uh-huh.
I've seen since I come home.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember that picture being taken. No.
Huh.
They were horrible pictures. They looked like they'd been in there for about a year already.
Oh, gee. Well,
we had a bad day, Rose.
I know that.
After what he has just described about having to bail out and that entire process, I just can't imagine anything other than looking like he'd pretty much been at the gates.
Yeah, well, like Rose said, a lot of it had to do with the what you lose in clarity on the picture is being shown again, or, you know, it keeps going through those different levels. But at any rate, it's difficult for me to imagine how Rose was able to press on with and keep the family going, because she didn't know what was happening with me.
That's right.
At least I knew that I was okay, relatively speaking, and so I think it was a much more difficult experience for her than it was for me.
Well, I mean, it's a remarkable testament to both your own, each of you, your personal integration and integrity and faith, and also the strength of your relationship. And I think it's that those pieces are what's so important that people understand. And again, acknowledging that John was there for less time than others, but in some ways it makes it more understandable because it's on a somewhat smaller scale. I think when we talk about the families of flyers who were incarcerated starting in 1965, I mean, it's almost incomprehensible to me, anyway. It's just unfathomable.
Well, you can imagine what it would be like to try to pick up their lives again after that many years separated.
Just
for us, in fact, my old crew, Laura, I was telling you about the crew I had before.
Yes, yeah.
It just so happened that they were on the same cycle that we were, so they went back in November like we did, and they got home, a week or two before I did?
They got home later?
Yeah, their normal rotation brought them back 2 days after, back from jail. So that was kind of interesting.
So you got the VIP speed.
That's right.
Speed return.
Right. I didn't have to fly all the time I was gone. I didn't have a flying schedule. So I lucked out.
Well, Rose, thank you. Thanks for participating. And let's take a break for today.
Okay. And, yeah.